the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Successive American administrations have been about the task of trying to manipulate population control. There's been a lot out there, a lot of dire warnings, going back to the 1960s, especially in the 70s, about a population explosion. There have been worldwide efforts undertaken by enormous organizations, the United Nations, American foreign aid programs, groups such as the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Ford Foundation. They've been out trying to control the decisions that human beings make about babies. Now, there are a lot of issues related to this, but a new book by Matthew Connolly, a professor at Columbia University, really raises these in a very, very important way. The book's entitled Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population, and in just a few moments, we're going to have Matthew Connolly as our guest. And the conversation is going to be really important because from an unexpected place, in this case, a history professor at an Ivy League institution, comes an analysis about, well, about the common wisdom that couples ought to be left, husbands and wives, to the decisions about children, not governments, certainly not massive international organizations. And it turns out that many of the warnings about a population explosion have turned out not only to be wrong, but to be almost fatally misguided. You'll enjoy the conversation with Matthew Connolly coming in just a moment on the Albert Mohler Program. First, to review some issues in the news, many of you may be unaware that you are involved in the abortion business. Now, before you begin wondering what I'm talking about, just consider that it's through the payment of U.S. taxes. In one recent year, $70 million in Title X family planning funds from the U.S. government went to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood of America is the nation's largest abortion provider. And last year, it now reports it crossed a milestone. That is over $1 billion in income. Tens of millions of those dollars coming from the American taxpayer. Now, you look at the financial reports from Planned Parenthood. You can find them at their website. In one recent report, the organization reported $112 million in excess of revenue over expenses. In other words, they ended up the year with $112 extra million. So why, then, is the U.S. government giving this organization funds? Senator Mike Pence of Indiana wants to put a stop to it. He points out that the government does not allow any tax funds to go to foreign organizations that promote abortion. So why, as a means of family planning, would this money be given to Planned Parenthood for activities here in the United States? You know, I think most Americans are simply unaware of the fact that their tax money makes them morally complicit in any number of things. The left, the political left, is always bringing this up related to issues of war and military action, and they're right insofar as paying taxes means you are a part of what America is doing in Iraq and in other parts of the world. But it's also true when it comes to issues of family planning and abortion. Our tax dollars are funding a budget that is itself a moral statement in terms of national priorities, programs, and policies. I think Representative Mike Pence is exactly right. We got to put a stop to this. And in putting a stop to it, it means cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood. So I would encourage you to get a hold of your representative and put a little pressure on your two senators in order to stop this scandal. Abortion is itself a national disgrace, and this funding puts every American in the abortion business. Fox News is out with a very interesting story saying that the dating relationship between adolescents has been transformed in recent years. Now, the story out of Columbus, Ohio, from Associated Press says this: forget about passing notes in study hall. Some teens are now using their cell phones to flirt and send nude pictures of themselves. The instant text, picture, and video messages have become part of some teens' courtship behavior, police and school officials say. Reynoldsburg, Ohio, Police Detective Brian Marvin, a member of the FBI Cybercrime Task Force of Central Ohio, says, I've seen everything from your basic striptease to sexual acts being performed. You name it, they will do it at their home under this perceived anonymity. Now, one of the interesting aspects of all of this is that sometimes these photographs, videos, and images don't even stay just between the dating couple. They get passed around. This is no news to anyone who knows adolescent male culture. But sometimes they're being passed around now as acts of vengeance when couples break up. and this can lead to all kinds of mischief and damage. It turns out, by the way, that these nude photographs are not only sent from girls to boys, but also, as the story says, male adolescents are also doing it. For instance, a Central Ohio high school teen made a sexual phone video of himself and sent it not just to one, but to several female classmates. One of the girls forwarded the video to at least 30 other people. Very interestingly, Jean Twinge, we've had her on this program before, a psychology professor at San Diego State University. She studies a lot of these things and trends. She says this: adolescents are not known for thinking things through. That's a generational constant. Now with the technology that is out there, instead of taking a picture and passing it around the classroom, it's online, which is a whole different ball game, and teenagers don't see it that way. End quote. Another reminder that parents need to be very vigilant, not only about where their teenagers go physically, but about where they go digitally. Not only what they do in terms of their physical space, but what they do in terms of their digital space and their digital lives. And I think an awful lot of parents, even Christian parents, will be shocked not only at what their kids send, but at what their kids receive in terms of digital messages, text messages, and of course now the photographs and videos that are available at your local cell phone. In California, there's a lot of concern right now about the fact that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said last week that he would now fight an initiative to amend the California Constitution to ban same-sex marriage. Very interestingly, in California, same-sex marriage is already illegal by a referendum undertaken by the people of that state. And Governor Schwarzenegger has vetoed bills that would allow gay marriage, but he says he's opposed to this amendment that would ban it. He says, as a matter of fact, that it would be a waste of time. The governor said, "I will always be there to fight against that." We should note that he was at that time speaking to the Log Cabin Republicans, the nation's largest gay Republican group. Jeffrey Kors, executive director of the gay rights group Equality California, said, "We are thrilled. We've been asking him to do this. The governor's support to defeat it is critical." Very interestingly, you start looking at this and you realize that the whole issue of homosexual marriage and the normalization of homosexuality itself is morphing before our eyes. And one of the ways it is being transformed in this particular time is by changing the ground of the discussion. And you watch what's going on in California, and Governor Schwarzenegger is one indication of where this argument is going. Speaking of arguments, there's a very interesting argument that most of us will simply be left out on, and that has to do with whether or not the new particle accelerator to be inaugurated in Europe is going to create a black hole that will simply swallow up the Earth. Just in case you're wondering if someone's been reading a little too much science fiction, this is coming from major news media, including the Los Angeles Times, similar stories in other leading international papers. It turns out the respected particle physicists are beginning to worry that this new machine, it is sponsored by the European Organization for Nuclear Research, known by its French acronym CERN. This is the $8 billion Large Hadron Collider, a massive assemblage of iron, steel, and superconducting wire 300 feet underground in a 17-mile-long circular tunnel on the border between France and Switzerland. According to the Los Angeles Times, this is the most complex piece of scientific equipment ever built. The collider will send particles crashing into each other at just a wink shy of the speed of light, generating energies more powerful than the sun. This particle collider accelerator is to begin its work this summer, and there are some, not just cranks, but some scientists who think that the net result of this could be the creation of a black hole. One of the leading scientists involved in the effort, Michelangelo Mangano, who is himself a particle physicist, he is the one who helped discover the top quark, that's an atomic unit, in 1995. He says, "Don't worry." Now, let me ask you, I don't know if you're worried or not, but let me ask you if his explanation assures you. This is what he says: "All of that energy would be concentrated in a space thinner than a human hair. Any black hole," he says, "would be so tiny that it wouldn't be able to get its teeth around a bit of local cheese, let alone the world." "Still," says the Associated Press, "if a black hole were produced at all," this is the LA Times, quote, "that would be an extremely spectacular result," he said with a half smile creeping across his face. Well, you know, time and time again, we get these warnings coming from people worried about the environment or population or whatever, that the world's coming to an end. But I really don't fear that the Earth will be destroyed by a black hole originating in this new particle accelerator on the border between France and Switzerland. But it is interesting that credible physicists seem to be involved in and engaged in a debate about it. Meanwhile, John A. Wheeler, the physicist who coined the phrase, the black hole, has died just this past Sunday, dying in Hightstown, New York, New Jersey, after teaching for years at Princeton University and the University of Texas. We'll be back to talk about what happens when human beings, governments, and international organizations try to control the most intimate human decisions, including decisions about having children. Population control's on the agenda when we come right back for the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
The provocative title of the book is Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population. The author is Matthew Connolly, who is Associate Professor of History at Columbia University. Professor Connolly, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I find your book fascinating, and I'm also very interested in the public response to it in terms of some of the reviews and news articles I've seen. But getting right to the heart of your title, which is indeed pretty provocative, what is the fatal misconception you're writing about?
Well, the fatal misconception is to think that problems like crime and poverty and war are biological in their origin and have technological solutions. And an even more fatal misconception, I think, is then to think that you can know other people's interests better than they know it themselves, to the point where you try to engineer their choices to get them to do what you think best.
And you're talking about reproductive choices here, and thus the title, Fatal Misconception. You're really talking about efforts to control world population.
That's right, because the people I write about worried about the way the population of the world was growing and changing. And they thought it was up to them, an enlightened few, to try to change that, to try to change the way people thought about their children, about future generations.
Now, let's play that out just a little bit. When would you date the beginning of that kind of global effort?
Well, in terms of a global effort, you'd have to date it to the end of the 19th century, because this was a time in which people thought the population of the world was out of control. They saw how it is that there were waves of migration across the Atlantic and the Pacific. They saw the way that fertility rates were beginning to decline in the wealthier industrialized countries of the West. And they saw how it is that tens of millions of people were dying of famines in South Asia and East Asia. And they began to see these trends as interconnected. And they began to see the possibility that you could start to shape people's choices, to create incentives and disincentives, and if need be, to create coercive laws to try to control how people reproduce themselves.
One of the most interesting aspects of your book, though, is that you deal with the fact that efforts to limit the population were actually barely disguised efforts to create a different population.
That's right. Whenever people would talk about the growth of world population as a problem and even a threat, they weren't usually talking about their friends and neighbors. They were talking about other people, different people, and oftentimes people they thought were lesser versions of themselves. And so it is that even if they didn't think, at least not at first, that it was necessary to pass laws to prevent people from having children or to give out permits, as China did with the one-child policy, just to permit parents to have children, they thought they would have to come up with some ways to shape their preferences, to get them to begin to realize that they should have fewer children for their own sake.
So let's go back to the early 20th century, late 19th century, and you have some early efforts to control reproduction. And let's say that before the emergence of the pill, you're talking technologically about some pretty limited options.
That's right. At the time, people were limited essentially to condoms, to their own imagination in some cases in terms of how they could try to, have relations typically with their spouse without having children. And at the time, ironically, many feminists were against contraception because they were concerned that, for instance, if they let men have condoms, that they would have sex with whoever they wanted without worrying about the consequences. So it was only in the early 20th century when people like Margaret Sanger could see how it is that new forms of contraception, such as the diaphragm, how it is that this would give women control of their own bodies. It's only then that they began to see contraception as something that could give women choices and give women power.
Now, we'll return to Margaret Sanger in just a moment. I was just reading last night a brand-new biography of Karl Brandt, who was Hitler's personal physician and was very much a part of the euthanasia and sterilization programs of the Third Reich. To what extent was forced sterilization a part of these efforts in the very beginning?
Well, from the very beginning, Margaret Sanger, for instance, thought that you should pay poor people to be sterilized. She said, beginning in the 1920s, that if poor people didn't see that it was in their own interest to have fewer children or none at all, then the government should give them money to get them to realize that they should stop having children for the good of all. So early on, people like Sanger began to think that if people couldn't be brought to their senses, then the government, and not just the U.S. government, but eventually the League of Nations, you know, the United Nations, would have to work together to try to bring people around by one means or another.
Now, let's talk about Margaret Sanger for just a moment. She is most popularly known in the American imagination as the founder of the movement now known as Planned Parenthood. But she was very much in the center of the eugenics movement in America in the early 20th century, eugenics being the effort technologically to breed a better race, a better breed. One of the statements she is known for is more children from the fit, less from the unfit. How does that fit both into the modern population control movement, and how does it fit within really an indictment of where we as a nation were on the issue of race and class?
Well, you know, unfortunately, somebody like Sanger in her time was considered a progressive. There were a lot of people on the left who thought that eugenics was something that could be good for everyone. So, for instance, African-American leaders like W.B. Du Bois, the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, they too thought that eugenics was the wave of the future. Now, Sanger, in context of her times, was not, for instance, a racist. She thought that, just like Du Bois, that eugenics was going to be something that was good for African-Americans, good for everybody. But unfortunately, there was that same troubling tendency to think that, in this case, if African-Americans didn't understand it, if South Asians, if Africans, if East Asians didn't understand their own best interest in planning their families and having fewer children, then again, it was up to the government to make those choices for them.
Now, let's put the population control movement in terms of some kind of ideological context. I mean, what's the worldview that would drive persons to believe that this is a rational and appropriate and moral way to try to address the human ills of the world population?
Well, you know, Dr. Moeller, when people see poor countries and they observe poor families and they see how it is that poor people typically have more children, that poor countries typically have high rates of fertility, they assume that there has to be a direct connection between the two. And they assume that if only there is a way of inducing people, persuading them, to have fewer children, to persuade poor countries to control their population growth, that this would help them become rich. And in fact, if you actually look at the data, there's actually no evidence for that, as amazing as it may seem. There is absolutely no correlation between rates of population growth and rates of economic growth. Within families, it's true enough that if you have fewer children, you might have a higher per capita GNP. But of course, most parents are quite happy to reduce their per capita GNP by having larger families. And most of them think they're better off for it.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, in for instance, agrarian societies, having more children might be a rational response to try to get out of poverty.
It's producing human capital.
We're talking with Professor Matthew Connolly about his new book, Fatal Misconceptions, and we'll be right back to continue the conversation. This is one of those issues that arises when we think we understand our history, only to be confronted with a book that reveals that we didn't understand it really in the way we ought. We'll be back to further this conversation in just a moment. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Our guest today is Matthew Connelly, Associate Professor of History at Columbia University and author of a very important new book entitled Fatal Misconceptions, The Struggle to Control World Population. Fatal Misconceptions, one of those books that is getting a lot of attention because it deals with an issue that a lot of people really haven't wanted to consider head on. Professor Connelly, I want to ask you a question about the cultural setting of all of this. One of the things I found most fascinating about your book is where you deal with successive presidential administrations. You deal with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Ford Foundation. You had the major institutions of American life buying into this kind of mentality.
Yeah, you did, alas, unfortunately. You know, and now we know at least part of the story because the archives have just begun to open up for the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. These were the wealthiest foundations of their day. They were the Gates Foundation of their day. And they carried out projects of astonishing scale. The Ford Foundation office in India, for instance, was second only to the American Embassy, you know, in the size of its staff. And they carried out experiments involving tens of thousands of people and seeing whether they could shape their choices about their children, about their future.
Now, looking at the argument you make about the fatal misconception, kind of an intellectual conceit that we could actually do good through these mechanisms, let me ask you to put it in a liberal conservative framework here just a little bit, because one of the interesting things that I found in your book is that this kind of mentality really crosses a lot of unexpected lines.
Yeah, it really does. You know, for instance, in 1968, both the Republican and the Democratic parties had as planks in their platform that the United States was growing at a rapid rate and had to do something to bring down the rate of population growth. This was really a bipartisan issue.
Now, looking at the big question of population growth, let's go back to the 1970s. There is the accusation, the claim that we are facing a population explosion. You have people like Paul Ehrlich and others warning in kind of a Malthusian sense that we're headed to a population disaster, worldwide famine, extinction of the race, actually, in some of the more radical literature. Is there a population danger, a population crisis worldwide?
Well, it really depends on how you imagine people living their lives in the years to come. Now, if the whole population of the world, that is, you know, some 6.7 billion people, all of them began to live like a lot of Americans do, you know, thinking that they can have two cars in the garage, perhaps a swimming pool and air conditioning all day long, then sure, we're in real trouble. But in fact, the world doesn't work that way. You know, when, for instance, people begin to use a lot of oil, you know, when China, for instance, begins to prosper, it drives up the price of things and people begin to conserve. They use less energy if they can't afford to use more. So, you know, that's how it is that biologists like Paul Ehrlich so often got things wrong. They treated people, they analyzed them as if they were ants or butterflies. And didn't credit them with the intelligence, you know, to make rational decisions about their future, without having to be scared, you know, into launching crash programs to control fertility.
Now, let's deal with the China one-child policy for just a moment. You really demonstrate what a disaster that has been.
It really has. You know, China's fertility rate was already falling 10 years before the one-child policy. Quite dramatically so. So, for instance, 1970, the average woman in China would have six children. By 1980, she was having about 2.7 on average. So long before the one-child policy started, Chinese people, because of their own reasons, because of market reforms and whatnot, were already beginning to have fewer children. But what the Chinese government did, by carrying out forced sterilizations, by carrying out coercive abortions, by issuing birth permits, what they did was they put parents in a position where they had to choose if they're to have only one child, then what kind of child will it be? Can we afford to have only one daughter, say, when it was sons that would take care of them in old age? And what this led to was waves of infanticide. More often, though, it led parents to begin using ultrasound machines to determine the sex of the fetus and to begin to abort fetuses rather than have baby girls, to the point where now, in some parts of China, the boys outnumber the girls 2-1.
There is a new Chinese proverb about that that talks about broken branches, young men who have no opportunity for a wife because of the very gender imbalance that Professor Connolly here mentions. We'll be back to continue this discussion in just a moment. I want to ask the professor how we tie together this whole population question and the ideologies and movements going on here with the issue of abortion. And that ought to be a different turn in this conversation, one I look forward to in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
History is littered with the ruins of utopian ideologies, both of the right and of the left. And one of those ideologies that is now a broken ruin is that of the population control movement. No one has documented that better than Matthew Connolly, associate professor of history at Columbia University and author of the new book Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population. Professor Connolly, in looking at this question, just dealing with my own concerns, I look at the question of how all this relates to the issue of abortion in America, Roe v. Wade. And let me ask you straightforwardly, is there a tie between the population control movement and the effort to legalize abortion in the United States?
Oh, sure. The first to begin to campaign to legalize abortion in the late 1960s, many of them were affiliated with Zero Population Growth, which was a group that wanted every American to pledge to have 2.1 children or fewer. So they felt it was necessary to begin to legalize abortion in the United States and to begin to encourage abortion in other countries. So, for instance, in the late 1960s, groups like the Population Council, for instance, one of the big NGOs in the field, decided they should start supporting research in sex determination. Some of the first ultrasound machines that went to China were provided through international aid. And in fact, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, had a plan to produce hundreds of thousands of low-cost abortion kits and began to distribute those kits worldwide with the idea that if they did that, it wouldn't matter what the law was in India or in South Korea, that if abortion became so cheap and so ubiquitous that people could do it for themselves, that no government could stop it.
Now, do I understand that you recently had an opportunity to talk at the World Bank on the topic of how the bank tried to control the population of the world and failed?
That's right. I appeared there on Tuesday, and I have to say it was one of the larger audiences that I've addressed, and it was one of the more curious because many people there had no idea about this history. Much like many of the other organizations now working in the field, a lot of people have come of age, you know, and joined organizations like Planned Parenthood and the Ford Foundation and the United Nations Population Fund just in the last 10 or 20 years. So they really, many of them, have no clue what was happening back in the 1960s and 70s when things really got started.
Now, let me ask you to look from the past to the present. Let's consider where the situation stands in 2008. Where do you see the most crucial issues that you would want your readers to focus concern?
Well, I'm really hoping that this book doesn't just become fodder, you know, for the culture wars, where people will just pick it up and try to find ammunition, you know, to make an argument for one side or the other. In fact, in writing this history of population control, I was trying to write a history of people who, even if some of them meant well, ended up demeaning the value of life at the same time that they undermined, you know, individual freedom. And in that way, I was trying to write a history of something that I think all of us should reject. So I wanted to begin with history to get people to think about the future and think about some of those issues where, in fact, pro-life and pro-choice people aren't necessarily, don't have to anyway, be on opposite sides.
Now, I understand that and appreciate your concern, especially having given so much of your time and life to a book of this massive proportion. I mean, actually, you know, our listeners can't see it, but I can guarantee you this is a major book, over 500 pages of rich documentation as well.
But I don't want to scare them off, Dr. Mueller.
Oh, that won't that won't scare this audience off. They weren't expecting this as a little tract. But I say that in order to indicate the magnitude of the research. I must say, in reading your book, I found few questions that you did not address and document related to this. But where would you like to see things go from here?
What I would like, what I would really hope for, is that people, whether they define themselves as pro-life or pro-choice, begin to think about the kinds of choices that we're going to face in future. And what I'm thinking about, for instance, is the rising rates of infertility. As bad as it is for any American couple who can't have children, rates of infertility are double in Africa. Many of those societies suffering from an epidemic of HIV/AIDS, some of them looking at absolute population declines. So this is a subject, infertility treatment for all, where I don't think that pro-life or pro-choice people need to disagree. Another would be looking at international adoption, which is a field that right now is completely anarchic. It's really out of control. There again, I don't see why pro-life and pro-choice people can't work together to try to reform international adoption. And I think that both sides could work against this new movement, a scary movement, really, that's rising up to try to promote the idea of genetic enhancement, to try to breed a new race of supermen. I don't think that's something that any of us want.
No, and you're looking there at another fatal misconception, and one that's also very injurious to the very idea of what it means to be human. And to be honest, that's one of the things that I found most fascinating about your work. You really get to the fact that all of these efforts to create a better race, not speaking just in terms of racial issues as we talk about today, but a better human species, really failed, and failed pretty spectacularly.
Yeah, economists just don't know where babies come from. There's no good fertility that can explain, much less predict, why people have children. It's hard for a lot of us to explain why we have kids, and yet we do, and we love our children. And I think that's something that the people who would like to reform society and make people better need to remember. You have to remember that it's up to parents, really, to make choices about how to have children and when to have children. And if you try to make their choices for them, it always has the most pernicious consequences. And we're going to be living with them for generations to come.
Yeah, just recently I was looking at some data comparing population growth or relative population growth between China and Japan. You're looking at two very different pictures there. In Japan, you're looking at rather small families on a small island, living in small apartments. And the point is that you don't have to buy entirely into some kind of economic rational choice theory to understand that people really do respond to the choices they have. And something like China's one-child policy, as you said, was a disaster. But, furthermore, just ignore the fact you're dealing with human beings here.
That's right, because it really comes down to the meaning of life, and how you value human life, and how it's a mistake for governments to try to put a price to people's lives, to begin, for instance, to pay people to have sterilizations.
Professor Connolly, thank you for joining us today on the program. I hope your book gets a lot of attention and also attracts a lot of readers.
Well, it's a dark subject, but I think it has really deep and lasting significance.
Well, very interestingly, some of the dark subjects that ought to compel our most thoughtful reflection, especially in dealing with something as important as the issue of human life, which is the undercurrent entirely of Professor Connolly's book, Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population, published by Belknap, Harvard University Press, available at your local bookstore, or of course, over Internet sources as well. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Well, now, that was a fascinating conversation, and the book's fascinating. The book's, of course, Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population by Columbia University Professor Matthew Connolly. Now, you will see this book being cited a good deal in the media, and, of course, some people are trying to do exactly what Professor Connolly said he didn't want done. Let's just put this in the culture war and figure out what it means for various debates today. On the other hand, you can't avoid that question either, because when you're looking at this data, it does remind us of the various ideologies, and let's say, right from the onset, some on the right, some on the left, various ideologies that attempted to control human beings through the control of reproduction, and in the end, really did horrible damage, and did not meet their goals. Now, one of the most interesting things Professor Connolly says again and again is that these people were well-intended. And I just want us to reflect on that for just a moment. Good intentions are not enough. Now, I would have to say that I would not even agree with Professor Connolly about the goodness of some of these intentions. But just looking at the historical pattern, let's just get that in our minds. Good intentions are never enough when you're dealing with human beings. And the good intentions they had did not play out because of the way they ignored fundamental realities about humanity. Now, reading this book as a Christian, I have to come back and say there are even deeper issues here. There are more urgent issues here. But what is very helpful about this book is the wealth of documentation and the explanation, the cultural and historical analysis that he brings to this. We begin to understand how this nation has been deeply complicit, along with other actors in the world, in efforts to control world population. I hope we feel embarrassed that we have felt that we were in a position to tell people in other countries how many children they should have, that we could and did, in this country, use our political and economic and social leverage to try to force countries to do what we wanted them to do. If you track back some of the most poisonous anti-human ideologies having to do with this, you will find the origin of many of these ideas, at least in terms of published and disseminated form here in the United States. It's an issue of our own humility and the recognition that this country bought into some of these ideas. And let's just say that it is very tempting to buy into some of these ideas, because it's very tempting to think that we know how other people should live their lives when it comes to these choices. I don't know about you, but I found it so tremendously refreshing to hear a professor in an Ivy League institution say, couples should decide how many children they want to have. Governments and bureaucratic institutions shouldn't intrude into that question. We should respect the decisions that families make, that parents make, and they're in a better position to make that decision than anyone else, than any government, than any bureaucrat, than any foundation, than any professor, ideologue, wherever he or she may be found. That, in itself, is a tremendously significant thing. I would recommend the book to you. It's big. It's documented. You should find it in your local library. I certainly hope you will, or also in the local bookstore. It ought to prompt a lot of discussion. And like so many of the right kinds of books, it should prompt the right kind of discussion. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday, a special email edition on the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.